Hello and welcome to Battle Rattle, a division of TACCOM Media. This is Triple D here on the mic, and with me, of course, in the studio is the founder of One Shepherd, Chris Larson, and also the co-host of Battle Rattle. Any little shout-out or any hello you want to give there, Chris, to anybody immediately?
Hello, Peoria. No, I'm fine.
I remember my first show as well, of course. And then, of course, with us here in the studio are, as a guest host, actually, is Alan Swayze from Operation Eastwind. Alan, welcome along. It's good to have you here.
Good to see you guys.
Good seeing you. We're going to be focusing a little bit on events throughout the show. That's going to be the content, I think, the meat of the show that we're going to get into is event planning and of those things and all that's entailed within. Before we really get into that, Chris, I'm going to go ahead and let you take over the mic. We've actually got an event, a specific event coming up that's pretty important involving One Shepherd, as I understand it.
Right. You know, as a matter of fact, we're putting this show together, and of course, by the time we release this show, it will have already passed. So we might very much do a follow-up then on the FTX. But this coming weekend, 15, 16, 17, April 2011, we have our 30-year anniversary. And of course, that FTX is out there with the Marine Platoon. It's a joint FEX-FTX, to use the Army-Marine vernacular. But it's really exciting because, of course, we have people coming in from 30 years now. 30 years. So we have people coming in from the 1980s, 1990s, and 2000s that are going to mix it up with the new students, of course, in One Shepherd's student leadership program. And we're out there for a full 3 days duking it out, again, with the Marine Platoon. So great stuff. I mean, we're anticipating, what do we got, 60, 70 people now we're looking at? I think somewhere in the nature of that, yeah. So, good stuff. And I guess that's the focus of this discussion, of course, is what it takes to actually put on a simulation of that size. It doesn't sound huge. I mean, we all know this. We've been part of simulations either on the training end, the administrative end, or even on the participating end that have had hundreds or even thousands of people for a weekend or for a week. And so something so simple as, oh, well, it's a three-day simulation, you know, and it's only, there's not hundreds or thousands, it's just, you know, 60, 50, 80, 100 people, you know, how big of a deal can that be? And I am surprised that when we sit and talk about this, and people who've been doing it, sometimes have been doing it for years, and they come in, they say, yeah, well, what's the deal, you know, and they listen, and the more they listen, you see their eyes kind of come open and they're saying, oh my God, I had no idea it was that involved. It was that large of an undertaking. And of course, it is, which is why we've invited Alan Swayze here. Because of course, they just went through Eastwind 4. And so this is 4 years in a row they've put on the Eastwind event. And that is the longest simulation, to my knowledge, outside of the United States military. That's the longest simulation going here in the United States. It's a full 9 days, right?
Yep, 9 days long.
9 days. So just an incredible stuff. And like I said, I don't think most people understand. When do you start planning your annual event?
Usually during the previous year's event.
Yeah.
We literally are making plans and ordering equipment, making changes, and considering how we're going to do things during the previous year's event. As we get going, after the event, we literally are demobilizing and preparing to remobilize the following event at exactly the same time. So literally there is no break whatsoever.
And when he says, Triple D, when he says he's demobilizing, what he means, let me put that in layman terms. What he means is he's taking vehicles, okay, military vehicles, in some cases armored vehicles, and he's caching them so that they are prepackaged, ready to go for the next year's event in warehouses across the country, in motor pools across the country, so that they're strategically located so they can get there, because it's an enormous cost in moving armored vehicles or any kind of military vehicles across the country, and some of them are coming from very far away. And it's not just that. He's doing logistics and tents and soft equipment like canvas tents that will, if you don't put it away right and in the right environment, when you go to get it 11 months later, it's rotten. It falls apart. So there's sensitive items like communication equipment that'll just be destroyed if you don't do this correctly. It's an enormous undertaking.
Oh yeah, just consider how much of a pain in the butt it is to have to open up every single case and take the batteries out of all the field telephones when you have as many field telephones as we have.
Because the alkaline will bust. No one thinks about that. The alkaline batteries will bust and eat your device when you come back to it a year later. I mean, One Shepherd does this too. Of course, we are on a higher rotation, shorter periods of time, but of course we do the three simulations or three training weekends anyway each semester, so we're seeing that six times a year. But we're still very much going through the same sort of thing. As a matter of fact, have you ever taken a gander at, that is a swag, a guess for us people. Have you ever, you know, this is in the Midwest, I'm allowed to say gander, don't talk back to me. Anyway, have you ever taken a guess at what, in terms of dollars, what kind of equipment you have on the field?
Oh, I don't even want to know. It is unreal the amount of equipment we take into the field. I cannot even begin to imagine.
Well, you know, I mean, the only reason I would even be able to guess is because I know what the initial, the initial investment back in 2007. But that's not an initial investment at all because, of course, we started in 1981 and we're 30 years old. But we know what the investment to go to Miles was. And, of course, all things considered, and that's tentage and vehicles and radios and miles and weapons, we made $250,000 investment then. Now, again, that's huge. That's significant. At least to us, $250,000 is, I mean, it's more than my house cost. So that's an enormous investment to me. But of course, we have a lot of community and alumni and community members at the time that had their own battle rattle, their own equipment, their own weapon systems, their own night vision, their own all these other stuff. So you, if you look at us as a community, we dwarf the $250,000 figure. Furthermore, we've expanded that community, obviously, since 2007, and more people show up with more and more hardware. So once again, we dwarf that $250,000. And if that's not impressive, then realize One Shepherd doesn't have any vehicles. Eastwind has Russian and East German vehicles, American vehicles, NATO vehicles, and again, some of them, more than just two or three, are armored vehicles. They've got British ferrets out there, you know, scout reconnaissance gun cars, which are armored. They've got tracked FV-432 multiple, you know, they've, you know, and that's, it's not just all Eastwind. D-Day owns, of course, some of those, but they've got Russian armored vehicles. So, you know, you look at this and you go, wow, the amount of money you have in the field at any given time. And money doesn't mean much to us. We don't really think of it in those terms. But I like to express it in those terms because I don't think people realize the undertaking they're stepping into.
Well, you know, it's interesting you were bringing up, you know, with the demobilization for the Eastwind event. And like you said, there are a lot of similarities with One Shepherd. While they don't have vehicles, or still you have to store equipment for the next event.
Sure.
Whatever interval that may be. And that inevitably is future-based. You're storing it, you know. So you have to attach it either. It's a chicken or the egg. You attach that as part of the planning and the ordinance for the current event, or it might overlap into the next event.
Sure.
But what I found interesting, and I would like to, Alan, if you've got to have a chance to maybe shoot some numbers as far as the amount of people that participate in Eastwind, because it, just from the communication of that alone, and of course with the equipment and the vehicles, it really is a perpetual swinging door. It just never ends.
Oh, it's continuous swinging door. We don't get a ton of people actually out in the field at each Eastwind event. We tend to be really specific in what we're targeting, and we try not to overreach. We don't really want a whole bunch of people who don't get it per se. So we got about 80 people this year, and if
80 people for 9 days,
yeah.
Wow, now that's,
everyone always makes the assumption we're going to have hundreds and hundreds of people out there, but it's just not really how that works, because you can't find hundreds and hundreds of people who've got their or squared away enough to do that.
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, he caught himself. Yeah. They don't have their squared away. Yeah, yeah. No,
squared away.
I think that's it. Well, the other thing there, in truth, Alan, it is slow growth. This is deliberate slow growth because you're fostering.
Well, we're going to get that to later. I have to be able to support whoever I have out there. I can't, if I have enough night vision radios and food preparation capacity for 100 people, and I have 150 people, then people, all 150 people are going to have a bad time because they're going to be in an environment that's ill-prepared for them.
Well, that's true, too. I didn't even think about the equipment. You're right. The equipment, I think, is kind of the obvious. But you're also, you are building administrators. You are building technicians. You're building tacticians inside of East Wind.
Yeah.
And again, I don't think people understand that.
Well, what size of cadre or what size of support review does it require to run this event? I mean,
more than we have. Significantly more than we have, as a matter of fact. But
what'd you feel this past event you had?
As far as
I promised him I wouldn't get into specifics about that event, but now we're on the air and I'm lying to him.
Just specific support staff actually in the field?
Yeah.
Yes.
Four.
Four to run. Those four people don't get a lot of sleep, do they?
No.
No, they don't. They run like crazy. And you really, what he's saying is, and having been there and seen it firsthand, what he's saying is the onus on the company commander, the company XO, and the first sergeant, so that command team of both the war pack, that is the Warsaw Pact side, and the NATO side, the onus on them is tremendous. These guys cannot, they can't just focus, well, I'm just going to do the bullet slinging stuff. No. In fact, those guys rarely get to do bullet slinging. They're so...
Unless they're doing it wrong.
Yeah, right. Right. If they're doing it very badly, then they're slinging bullets. They're so preoccupied with logistics and management of their combat maneuver units that... And it has to be that way because, as Alan just said, there are four people that are essentially running... Do you call them... You don't call them OCs, but you call it a white cell, though.
Well, we have our two white cell guys, and we have admins on each side. So I'm the admin for NATO, and Brett Compton's the admin for the East Block. And then that's the four of us that are running it in the background, per se.
And that's, you know, to be honest, that's very typical of One Shepherd, too. We are slightly larger sometimes, but sometimes we're down to three or four guys. Typically, we have a white cell of two or three people in the white cell, and then we'll have OC, so kind of the admin guys. And you're not going to get, generally not going to get more than two on the Blue 4 side and two on the Op 4 side. So you're looking at six or seven, like this coming FTX, we'll have 60 people out there, and we'll probably have around seven people actually running the show. We'll actually be about seven people for 60 people over a three-day event. And once again, that means that we run platoons where they run companies, but the platoon leaders and platoon sergeants... There's a lot of onus on them to get the job done. Where there's not a whole, there's a whole lot of support for them. But ultimately, you know, this is a good time to talk about it. This is an excellent time to talk about it. There's all sorts of support for them, Triple D, in terms of resources. But they're not a customer. And I think that's what sets a simulation apart. An effective simulation, the ones that I see that are done the most effective. The participants are participants. They are not a customer. Dude, when you're a customer, you walk into the movie theater or you walk into, you know, a hotel, you know, whatever, Express, Holiday Inn Express, whatever it is. You walk in there, there's a certain amount of service. Not resources. There's a certain amount of customer service that you anticipate. What you wouldn't expect is to walk into a Holiday Inn Express and they say, we've got you taken care of here. No sweat. You see, over there are your towels. Over there are your, you know, sign yourself in over there. And then make sure that you're cleaning up after yourself as you go. What? That's resources without the service. And the thing is, simulations, they don't have much in the way of service. They have resources. And you are a participant. You are part of the team. You don't lay in the sack in the morning and say, oh, well, gee, I hope I can make it to breakfast this morning if I can get myself out. No, it's not that kind of a place. This isn't, yes, there are accommodations for you. But no, you don't sleep till you want to get up and then go play war.
Well, I think, you're in the business of marketing and experience. So when you say that those participants are not, obviously they're participating, but they're not clients, well, they're not. They're also clearly not purchasing something and going home or saying, hey, have it shipped to me. You know, they're in the business of, or in the situation where they're they're buying into an experience or they're seeking an experience. That's what these different ones, One Shepherd and East Wind both provide from a Milsim standpoint. But it's funny you mentioned, like, your staff. The thing I'm thinking about is that doesn't happen overnight.
Uh-uh.
So you developed these, I'm assuming, and now I'm familiar with One Shepherd a bit more. Pardon me there, Alan, but, you know, I've seen firsthand that they're developing it from their core, people that go through the slip and or become just in love playing.
Sure.
So they step up. But that kind of commitment in itself, all the time invested by those people to get to that point, and then, of course, to be nurtured along, which we're going to get more into, like you said, into, you know, the culture of it.
Well, but I appreciate that because it is a labor of love, both for the Eastwind staff and for the One Shepherd staff, and I've seen this in other staff as well. What I mean by that is these guys aren't paid.
Right, exactly. That was my point. You were bringing up dollars and cents, and I'm thinking, wow, just the time invested where you really can't measure that in dollars and cents.
No.
That's an enormous amount of work that goes into just one event or multiple
right,
events.
Right, because it's not just 9 days at Eastwind. It's not just 3 days at a One Shepherd FTX. Let me illustrate that. How many events do you have at Eastwind? How many events do you have before you actually have your Eastwind event?
Are you talking about training events or are you talking
sure.
about work events?
Both. Yes, work events and training events.
Well, if you want to look at work events on the smaller scale, there's about 50 weekends in the year that we're not doing Eastwind actually at the time, so that would be about 50 events.
So you're working weekends, almost working.
Every weekend we're doing something, and usually there's people over at the house helping out, doing some little bit or another, whether it's trying to repair a radio, figuring out how to make a teletype machine work, sewing tents back together, cleaning kitchen trailers, you know, changing tires on the trucks, things like that. We're pretty much every weekend are doing something.
And if it's not maintenance that they're pulling constantly, or a planning meeting that they're pulling, then it's training. And I know, what would you guys, I know you guys had your combat leaders course.
Yeah.
You had your land navigations course. And that was just the NATO side.
Yeah.
And then the Warsaw Pact, the Warpact side, also had training.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they did for sure. I think they did a leadership one, and I believe a reconnaissance weekend also.
Okay, so there's two different entire weekends for the Warpact that are dedicated training, two different weekends for NATO that are dedicated training. You're already up to four training events throughout the year.
We used to do one per month starting in August, and we're probably going to start doing that again. But yeah, it was one per month.
So yeah,
leading up to it.
So all those events and all those man hours are really, in essence, planning for one event.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Well, you're trying to build a community of people who are capable of functioning in the field. We've made mistakes about assuming that it carries over particularly well from year to year. But yeah, you have to have a lot of time in the field, people actually outputting skills to practice. Otherwise, they simply forget them, or it doesn't get disseminated down. So people don't understand what it is that they're supposed to be doing once they get there. Land navigation, in particular, is one that we harped on endlessly. Got to hammer on people about land navigation, because it doesn't matter how good you are when you get to the fight. If you don't get to the fight, the fight's lost.
Well, this is just it. You know, people talk about this. So what's the biggest breakdown? Land navigation, frankly, is not one that's mentioned the most. The most commonly mentioned is communication. But land navigation, frankly, at the same time, is every bit as important as Alan just said. If you can't get to the fight, then you lose by forfeit. And these are large areas that you're generally working in. You know, a mile by a mile is not uncommon, all right? So you can get out there and get lost in, you know, when it's 40 degrees, cold, raining, and pitch black at 2 in the morning. And so, you're in whatever kind of terrain, you know, so you're easy to get lost out there and not show up the right place at all. But in addition to that, then you have other competencies. You have competencies in communication, specifically radio communication, but not just radio communication. There's a lot of communication.
Yes, you have to put batteries in the field telephones. And then when you get the next field telephone, you have to put a battery in that field telephone. And then the one after that, you also have to put a battery in that field telephone. So yes.
You know, you think he's joking there. But
I'm not joking.
No, unfortunately, he's not. And these are competencies that you have to foster. There's all these technical, we all go, there's all these technical competencies, and then here's the real elusive one. Wait for it. Leadership. Just because you kick Buddha in, I don't know, what's the latest video game they play now?
No idea.
Call of Duty.
Okay, yeah. Just because you can
Super
go out there
Mario
and
Brothers.
Crush people in Super Mario Brothers Call of Duty, just because you can do that doesn't mean that you know squat about leadership, let alone land navigation or communications, but it doesn't mean you know squat about it. You don't understand the leadership models, the decision-making models, how you prepare a pre-combat inspection for your troops, you know, all how you disseminate information down and disseminate it and receive information up, and how and who and when you pass that information on to your higher command. All of these things are not intuitive. They're just simply not. But people say, my gosh, I've been playing Airsoft in California, and we've got a serious team. I think four of my 12-man team, we're going to go out to Eastwind this year. And when they get out, they're a little overwhelmed, to say the least. They're like, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? Because there is so much that's going on here that you can't just show up and develop these competencies in the first two or three days of the simmering tensions of the simulation. You've got to do that on an annual basis. And as Alan says, it's an ongoing process because, I don't know, I'm going to take a guess, but I'm going to say half the people you have this year, you won't have them next year. So those won't be your company commanders and squad leaders. Then again, sometimes you're lucky and you get a lot of the repeat guys. That's good.
The ones that don't get taken by the Army and the Marines.
Yeah, yeah, right. Right. Get sucked up by the big Army. Yeah, so... no, this is absolutely true. And of course, One Shepherd feels that pain because we're a student leadership program. And gee, as a student program, you're right. We're transient, just like all student programs. We're like a college or a high school or anything else. You come in, you spend 3 years, you're gone. Just when you get really good and we start to get some bang for our buck out of you, oh, you're taking off for college or the military.
Well, that comes right down to, again, goes back to the time that you're putting into events, because training is event preparation. In essence, I mean, it gets the participants to a level of proficiency where they're going to be able to take full advantage of the scenarios inside each event and function within the protocol, the SOP, I guess, for lack of a better acronym there. And like when you talk about having a revolving door, you are trans, and that means you're spending just that much more time on training, which is, again, event planning, event preparation. So you see, once again, much more work. It never goes away.
Right.
It's something, you know, when you really think about everything that goes into it.
And I feel Alan's pain because, you know, we're in such a better, as bad as it is for us in One Shepherd in that regard, Triple D, as bad as it is, we've got it in spades over Eastwind, because Eastwind is once a year event, once a year simulation. And so then they wait for the next year, and then they've got people dispersed all over, literally the globe. You guys had guys in from England and Saudi Arabia this time.
One guy from Saudi Arabia who's English.
Yeah, okay, there you go. But they're pulling them in, and so there's no way of getting those guys back. Where at least with our student leadership program, we are geographically co-located somewhat. We're spread across about a 4 to 5 hour radius, driving radius. But we're somewhat co-located, so it's reasonable for us to come back. And the truth is, if you really look at our semester, we say we have 6 events per year, and that's true. We actually have some work parties in addition to that, usually about 4 more weekends a year of work parties. But what it really comes down to is we have 2 FTXs. Each semester culminates with a field training exercise. That's the FTX. And that's a simulation. That's a 48 hours spread over 3-day, nonstop, go for it simulation. So we have 2 simulations a year. And we build 2 training weekends to that simulation and approximately 2 work weekends to that simulation. So we build to that simulation. I think people, if you were, Triple D, if you were to ask one of our students right now, when does the One Shepherd staff start building the FTX? They would tell you, oh, 2 weeks out. Because they know that's the final registration for late registration. So they would say, oh, it's 2 weeks out. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They do a final headcount then, and that's when they start building. Not realizing that, no. For the FTX in April, mid-April, we're planning, I mean, quite literally, the weekend of New Year's weekend. So whenever New Year's falls, we're planning usually right before that or right after that, depending on when the staff meeting happens. So that's another whole meeting, weekend. Is staff meeting, because there's staff development. Then there's the cadre development course, which is yet another. That's staff development course. So there's these kind of weekends that they're even further hidden yet. And so this is a 3.5 month build, each one of them. And yet we have all of these time to do that. I've got people in this program generally about three years at a time. They make roughly a three-year commitment. Poor Alan and Brett Conklin out there, they put this up from a much larger geographic area. They have all a year to build it, but people aren't committed to their program except for 1 year at a time. And so that's pretty much, wow, phenomenally difficult.
Well, we've got a pretty good group of guys that will show up and work on things. We refer to them as the usual suspects. And I think every event planner's got the usual suspects.
We do.
Who will get there every time and help out. This last weekend, I had one guy that came up from St. Louis to work on things for Saturday, and another guy that drove out from Fort Riley to work on things for Sunday. And as usual, the usual suspects were there, and we worked our butts off, and that's just how the kind of thing works. It's what you get. You've got people who are willing to chip in, and those are the ones you got to rely on. But, you know, getting back to Christopher's point about time, I mean, when you're looking at this just from a more broad perspective, not just specifically what One Shepherd and what Eastwind does, look at it from the perspective of anybody trying to run an event. Think about location for your event. Let's say we want to run an event for 200 people and we want it to be an overnight event. And we want to have the 200 people start off in locations that are not the same parking area. Okay, now I've got to go find a location to run my event at that is large enough that I can run a 24-hour event and not have people constantly on top of each other. And I have to have two separate parking areas.
Yep.
And I need to have hard enough surfaces I can park there in all weather, because I don't know what the weather's going to be for my event that's happening in 4, 6, 8 months, whatever we're going to
sure.
do. And I have to have it be affordable. And I have to be able to guess in my head how many people I think are going to come to this event. And from that, what I think I can reasonably charge people. And then from that, what can I afford to pay a landowner? And then I have to go find a landowner.
Right.
Okay, so now I have to begin this process. And every time I have to go find a landowner, that means I have to go to look at someone's land, which is realistically going to be a day and a half prospect, just to see if it's suitable.
Right.
And I may have to repeat this prospect 10, 15 times to find a place that's suitable. Okay. And this is something that every event planner's got to go through, to find the spot that'll work. And then you're going to find the places that maybe will work and maybe they won't. Maybe it'll work if I have to put a gate in over here. Maybe if I gravel this road a little bit, you know, what happens if, okay, well, what if I only use high mobility vehicles to get to this area here? And there's a lot of work goes into that kind of thing, too. Just simply getting a hold of a piece of property that will work and then doing whatever work you have to do to that property to make it where it's functional can be a lot to work with. And then especially because very few people realize that the kind of people who own properties that are fallow and able to be used for this kind of thing are frequently crazy people. And I can tell you that having dealt with a few of those in the years past, it can be kind of tedious sometimes to have to explain to them every time you talk to them that you talked to them before and we have this agreement and this is what we're doing. And then you have to explain to them how the whole thing works again. And then you show up for your event, and they think you're going to have a mud derby.
Oh, no, I know. You find them. He's not joking.
Yeah.
You have people that are afraid you're going to go out there and scare their peacocks. What?
Don't have any peacocks.
We don't have any peacocks. But, you know, you're going to scare the peacocks away. And if you think I'm joking, these are real things that happen. We've gone out to events and found the landlord of the event. This is a great big open farms, right? He's crashed out in a drunken stupor in his barn.
Oh, yeah. A couple times I've had that one happen.
And he threw a big party the night before, so the place is just trash, and he's there in a drunken stupor. I mean, you get some real doozies that you wind up going, ha, I see why this land has never been developed now.
Yes, I agree. Now, it's also clear to me now.
I mean, now, to be fair, boy, we better make this clear, too, because they just, Eastwind 4 was held down at D-Day Adventure Park in Wyandotte, Oklahoma. And, of course, you couldn't ask for a better landowner there. I mean,
he's a good kind of crazy. We like him.
Yeah, he's Dwayne Conveyors is, that's true. He's still crazy, but he's the good kind of crazy. Yeah, I mean, he's the good kind of crazy that has just wonderful facility. And that's hard to find because when, as Alan said, when you find all that, and he was going over the trials and tribulations of finding it, once you find it, now, he's saying parking. Parking's one infrastructure. You also got to figure out, where is everybody going to pee and poop?
Where am I going to get water?
Where do you get water?
How far do I have to drive to get water?
How are you going to get the trash out? How are you going to collect it and then get it out? People think, well, you don't need that. You're camping. Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, you do. 80 people in one spot, one square mile, for 9 days, you've got to worry about trash.
A lot.
And so you don't think, oh, these, all these things. This is what was cool. It was before the show, of course, that Al and I were sitting there talking about it. And when one of these company commanders or platoon commanders goes out, let's say for the Blue Four, and they, for the first time ever, put their unit in the field, and they come back after that simulation, and they are dumbfounded. They are emotionally and physically exhausted, and they're saying, oh my God, Chris, is this what it's like each and every time? And I say, oh, you only saw 20% of it. You only saw 20% of it, and the Op 4 commander saw 20% of it. Together between you, I'd say you saw roughly 40% of what a simulation takes, because you didn't see the other 60% that is administrative and ongoing. And I mean, you can see them. They're just crushed. They're like, how can you do this? And how can you do it for free? Well, it's a labor of love. We work with volunteers and volunteer staffs and everything else.
And we're also crazy, too.
Yeah, I'd have to say there's probably just an element of...
The words right out of my mouth there.
Probably an element of instability. What's that? With the guy who chased the windmills?
Don Quixote,
yeah. We're up.
You know, it's an elusive thing you market. The experience, sure. The atmosphere. It's an innate thing. It doesn't necessarily, obviously, isn't a fixed product or something you produce off of an assumed line. But, you know, you guys are both talking about, with your respective platforms that you use, your organizations, you mentioned that you have individuals that you can delegate to that will actually help shoulder the load, even if it's just 20%, you know, from the participant, but also from an administrative level.
Yeah.
How does that come about? Particularly, like you just mentioned, you know, the biggest thorn I can see in the side of, you know, finding that situation is you don't have money to. You're, you know, these people are all volunteers. So,
can I field that one first, and then
please do?
Okay. Here's how that comes about. People honestly want to be part of something larger than themselves. Now, obviously, not everybody. Some people are narcissistic and think the universe should bend to them. But aside from those narcissistic people, people genuinely want to be part of something bigger than themselves. And when they look at something like D-Day in Oklahoma, when they look at something like Battle of the Bulge in Pennsylvania, when they look at East Wind and One Shepherd, and they see these ongoing traditions, they say, my gosh, I really want to be part of that. And they initially, most of them, by and large, will start off as a participant, and then work their way up through the ranks, and then eventually assume some kind of command leadership position. And then see, every time they do, every time they go up a little higher, they see what the next rung above them is doing, and they say, gosh, you know, there's a certain amount of the cream rises to the top, right? And those cream rise up there, and they say, I'm looking for my challenge. I'm looking for something bigger than myself. These are wonderful human beings to work with. They're the type of people you wish you got to work with Monday through Friday at your real job. And so they come in, and of course, yes, it still takes a lot of work with them. Still takes a lot of, you know, mentoring. But what we're doing there is we are fostering a community. And this gets far more, I already started talking about that earlier in the show when I said, you're not a customer. You're not a client. You know, you're one of our members. You're a community member. Well, even more so for those usual suspects who show up, you know, every third weekend of the month to help do maintenance, and those others that step forward and say, hey, you know, I'd like to be a part of the administration. I'd like to help out here. That's a beautiful, beautiful thing about these types of organizations. And again, you want to definitely foster that. There was a time where people thought One Shepherd was Christopher Larson or Christopher Larson and Jeff McGay. Let me tell you, that's couldn't be further from the truth now. One Shepherd is a large community with a 30-year alumni, 300-plus members over the years, and probably somewhere 40, 50 active members today. Plus, we interface with other wonderful organizations, including ROTC, but not the least of which is Eastwind. We interface with them, and there's a lot of cross-pollination. With D-Day, again, a lot of cross-pollination. Wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff. But it's developing that community.
So it's not an accident, then, by any means. That's probably somewhere in the philosophy, is creating this, fostering this type of community, which will allow for these people to come to the
table. I'm going to be honest. It was an accident. No one's going to admit that, and they don't want to, and I don't want to. I want to tell you that I set out intentionally to do this. It was an accident that, fortunately, early enough on, years and years and years ago, I recognized what was happening, and I said, whoa, let's take hold of this. Let's start fostering. Let's be more intentional about this so it's no longer an accident. But sure, it was an accident initially. I didn't realize that's what was going to happen. Now, I don't know. What's your take on it, Alan?
I tend to think the same thing. And actually, there's other things that will tend to get people to rise to the top as well, and that is simply seeing a need. If you're working at something and you're struggling at it and you're doing it as well as you can, but it's obvious that you can't, or it's obvious that someone else is sitting outside and goes, you know, that guy's, he's got 11 different things he's trying to do, and he's trying to pick up this 12th thing. It obviously is something he's not got the time to mess with, or he's not got the skill set to do it well. I can do that 12th thing.
Yeah.
And he'll say, hey, you know what? I really like to cook, so why don't you let me take the field kitchen stuff and I'll take care of the field kitchen.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I'm really into radios. I'm kind of interested in learning a little bit about how the radios work. Why don't you let me take over some of the radio stuff? Or I want to learn how to use the telephone systems. I work on all the wires, so I'll take care of all the PMing of the wire. Just people seeing a need and recognizing that they can make a contribution. I mean, and that's the case a lot of times with people who are perhaps not physically as able but are very mentally sharp, who really want to contribute in a useful way to something like that. They can look at this and say, well, hey, you know, I can take this one aspect of the event and really make it right. And that's how you get a lot of that stuff too. People just want to pick up the ball and do the best they can with what they can. And a lot of times it's just a matter of seeing a need. So when you've got people who are too proud to admit that they're not doing something well, those are usually the people that really, really struggle. When you're smart enough to know that you're not doing something well, that's where you'll usually find your person that's wanting to step up.
And you're talking about me here, and he's absolutely right, because I did struggle with that. I struggled with that for many years, that I felt like I should be doing all of these things, and I should be doing them well. And it's taken me a while to develop and foster that staff, but really, at the same time, while I'm trying to do that, I'm also struggling internally. That is, internally with myself, saying, okay, Chris, okay, calm down. Let other people take the reins. Trust them. And you know what? Triple D, I swear to you, there's been a few times where we've fallen on our face, but only a few. Far more times, not only do they go and they do it successfully, they do it much better than I was doing it. They're right. As Alan said, they came up and they said, Chris, you're not doing this marketing thing very well. Let me run your forums. Let me do whatever it is. And I go, oh, there's this fear of letting go of that control. And then when I see it 6 months later, you know, and I go, oh my gosh, it looks better. It runs better. This is far more efficient. It's a much better job than I could have done. And that's what I mean. One Shepherd is not Christopher Larson. It's much bigger. And I feel like, Eastwind is becoming, for many years now, it has been Brett and Alan. Brett Conklin, Alan Swayze. I feel it's at that tipping point now where it's going to be a larger community.
Sure. Well, you know,
it'll have to be.
You know, you mentioned some of the things. Someone who makes a decision to take over, they feel like someone's overtasked, or like you said, they see a need. You know, that concept, to me, when I think about it, the first thing where it comes to mind is leadership. You know, and some of the best, that's an example of leadership.
Sure.
You know, and, you know, one of the best, it really was more of in a civilian format. It was actually in a managerial standpoint, but a mentor of mine, this is more of a corporate level, but it translates over. Certainly a lot of the stuff that I use from One Shepherd as a doctrine, it carries over into other parts of my life too, so I have no harm, feel no embarrassment for giving something back. But he used to say, one of the smartest phrases he ever used to say to me was, leadership calls to you. Leadership calls to leadership. You know, and when you mentioned like that phenomenon where the cream of the crop is rising to the top, you know, but it doesn't, you know, yes, they have the upper mobility, but they see it, they see a need to fill, but there's also, they also see the leadership from the other side. One's calling to the other. So leadership kind of calls to each other in that regard. And when you think about all of that, that once again, and I'm a big fan, you're a big fan of expressing it in dollars and cents as far as the preparations involved, but I'm a big fan of expressing the innates almost priceless. It would be near impossible to put a dollar amount to the value of some of the things that people do as far as contributing to the event, whether it's ordnance or management, or, you know, taking care of radios, calling people, that kind of stuff.
Right.
How would you put it? I mean, could you put a man-hour count on something like that? No. That would be a phenomenal figure, I would think.
It would be. And I'll tell you something. I like the way you expressed that and couched it because, and it will go nameless. We will not name. I'm saying this to Alan because he knows. Alan, of course, was our S3 in One Shepherd for what? A couple years, right?
Yeah.
And so he's worked with a lot of different clients. One Shepherd's worked with a lot of different clients, but he'll know who I'm talking about right away. I don't have to mention name. And we've seen more than one client do this, but one client more than others. And that is, you're talking about those that rise to the top. You have to be careful here because the way you couch it was, yes, they rise to the top to leadership. That is, they rise to the top because, again, they want to be part of something bigger than themselves, and they want to do service. Alan and I have seen organizations where what rises to the top is rank has its privilege, R-H-I-P. I rise to the top because this is my 8th year in this organization. I rise to the top because I brought X amount of dollars worth of equipment, or I rise to the top because I recruited this many people. So they were good at doing these other tasks, but they weren't good at service. And they'll let you know straight up. They will say things to you. And yeah, unfortunately, some people in our listening audience are going to hear this and know, you know, people like this. I'm not going to say names or anything like that. They're just going to say, yeah, I know people like that. Where they say, yeah, man, this is my 5th year at this, you know, event or this within this organization. So I don't have to do the dirty details. I'm going to hand that all down to you guys. And when you get up to my level, that's when you can start picking on the younger guys too. And no, that's not what. I'm not saying all do.
That is, by the way, extremely prevalent problem with reenacting. You see.
Yes.
I can afford to have a Kuba wagon. Therefore, all of you shall be my peons.
That's right. I'm telling you, we saw this. There are very, very good reenacting companies. I've seen Vietnam, World War II, reenacting companies. Those are my only experience. But, I mean, phenomenally good stuff. Brilliant stuff out there. Unfortunately, they are the exception. What normally happens is, just as he said, I own all 3 tanks in this platoon. And therefore, I'm the platoon commander. And, oh, by the way, I don't need any NCOs. This is an authoritarian dictatorship. My tanks, guys, like it or leave it. Wow. Not exactly the kind of organizational leadership you want.
Well, your experience is going to suffer inside any one event when you have that kind of attitude. As you said, if it's prevalent throughout your event, and then the other participants are just quite honestly are not going to get as good an experience.
No, they don't. They don't. So, like I said, you know, you have to be careful here because you do want to foster a community, yes, and all of them do that. But you have to be careful what kind of community you're fostering because, again, what you want to foster in is service. And that's what Alan talks about when he says the usual suspects. Well, we have a work detail. Who shows up? The usual suspects. Those that, you know, that you've done, you go, gosh, it's great. These guys are really looking for the service. Well, make sure you're promoting those guys. Make sure those guys are, you know, are getting staff positions. Make sure, you know, you want to get something done, give it to a busy man, right? Well, you want faithful service, give it to those usual suspects who show up for service. They may not be the sharpest tactician out there. They may or may not, but you can foster that. You can teach that. That makes sense?
Well, it makes total and complete sense. You know, it's funny, I think, you know, of course, like you said, they all establish a community, but being specifically what type of community, you know, a service-based one that you establish, that culture you establish, it leads to what you get is I think that it's at the same time it helps foster that kind of extra commitment in terms of just attendance for events. Say, for example, even if you're not going to become one of the usual suspects, but you're at least motivated to be able to make a commitment and keep your calendar straight.
That's right.
You know, when you see that kind of community, it mitigates against missing those events.
That's right, because you got a 9-man squad that's going out to do a mission, and you realize that if you blow them off, they're down to 8. Their combat power is down for that simulation. Just because you decided, you know what? I'd rather go to the concert. Or it's cold this weekend. Yeah, you're right. You need to... I keep saying the same word. Sorry for being a broken record. I don't know how else to say it. You need to foster that community that says, you know, I just said earlier that there's resources but no service. That's what I mean. The service is what you give as a participant, not what you receive. It's what you give. And that's the trick to having a successful community, is fostering that sense, that willing service in each person that participates.
Now, would you say that there's a sense of camaraderie that kind of holds each other accountable for that kind of thing?
You bet. And I think it builds that kind of camaraderie. I think it really does.
Well, I mean, you know, you've got your higher ups, of course, you're going to be holding someone, but you know, you're just really a fire team leader or someone, or you're a member of your fire team. If you're the fire team leader, it's like, hey, let's make sure you're here for this event. And
well, you know, Drew, you've been there. Alan's certainly been there. We've all been there. What these things do really well, again, you get to be part of something bigger than yourself, but there's also, they're called people-intense environments. That's what these things are. There's others, of course, the universities and the military experience and stuff, schools. But these are simulations are people-intense environments too. So you know when you've done a good job. And they may not call you up in front of the formation and pin a fancy ribbon on you, but everybody in your unit knows you've done a good job. You know, that gets the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, that self-esteem, that self-actualization. You don't get to reach that level of Maslow's in every endeavor that you take on in life. In fact, in most, you simply don't achieve that level. Oddly, in these simulations, in these training events and simulations, in these developed communities, you do reach some level of Maslow's. Now, the question is, do you want that level to be, look at my shiny new toys. I've got more shiny new toys than you have. Or, I mean, because who's kidding who? I love shiny new toys, too. They're sexy.
Shiny toys.
Yeah. See, Alan's there, too. Yeah, who doesn't like shiny toys? We're men. Men. We all like shiny toys, but is that where it ends? Is that where you go, yeah, look at my shiny new toys? Or does it say, no, look at the bond I have with these guys. Look what service I give my troops. Look what service I give my team. And you don't even have to say that, because by coming and showing and being that guy, everybody already knows you're that guy.
That makes it real, you know, it's morale building. What was the old?
Oh, yeah.
The old axiom is the catch-22. People who produce good results tend to feel good about themselves. People who feel good about themselves tend to produce good results. You know, and then when you like said again, going into the community thing, you foster that kind of environment, and it leads to those kind of things where you're going to see, like you said, inevitably your usual suspects will show up, even from new guys. Somebody says, hey, I really genuinely want to be service-based in this, even though I'm not using the nomenclature necessarily, but they're saying, hey, I really want to be involved, and it's not because I've got these tanks to bring to the battlefield or these vehicles. It's because I really want to provide service. You know?
Right, and that's usually what we get. The guys who are most willing to provide a tremendous amount of service are the guys that generally have the least amount of time, the least amount of resources, and oddly enough, they're oftentimes the ones that are located very far away.
Yeah.
And they still make the effort and the trek to.
I got guys, you know, we've got guys that will work really, really hard at helping us talk to people about things and promote things. And we'll work hard from California.
Yeah.
And from, you know, very distant places. They'll put a lot of work in to make sure things get done.
They will.
You know, so for those listeners out there, that's kind of sort of a lesson, sort of a conclusion somewhat, and if you'll pardon the expression, to our show here, is that, like you said, you're not a client, you're a participant. And there's a lot of responsibility that falls on your shoulders, not the least of which the debt you may owe to all the planning, all the people that put all their time in for the planning. Like you said, yours never ends. It's year round. But also just the participation, the right type of service-oriented leadership that you want out of your people. You know, I can remember the FTX I went on towards the end of the semester. That again, we were down in Columbia. I actually got cited. I was part of a fire team with the Marines, actually. Great FTX. Rained. 50 degrees. You know, and it's funny because the same community that we're talking about is what helps uphold your morale. And morale was low at serious points. I mean, it wasn't fun. There's no inside to go to. Everything's wet. It's 50 degrees. We've been fighting for 4 hours.
Right.
You know, and you're happy to be done fighting, but then you sit still and you're getting rained on and you're not fighting. Like, boy, I wish I was fighting again.
Yeah.
Just so I could get warm. You know, it's that type of morale. And I remember we actually lost one of the guys that actually, I mean, the weather was real extreme and he kind of fell out. He went to his, right. You know, and I really felt so bad for the guy, but it's again, like you mentioned, you're brilliant, you know, beautiful, you know, illustration of how you feel like you're part of something bigger.
Right.
And I just, as much as I would rather, if you would have asked me at any given time, would I rather be inside by a warm fire and dry? And yes, and you would be the answer to all those questions. But there's absolutely no way that I could even find myself to do that because of the community. It's not, I'm not singing my own praises. I'm saying that that pressure is there. It's like, hey, you're
right. You're in this together.
Yeah, you don't want to lower the fire strength. And
right.
Well, every single one of the people in that group could have gone home and been sitting by the fire, and they chose to be there because of the bond of the community.
Right.
That's what you're trying to work with. That's what you're building on.
It's well, you know, I would submit that, you know, we're, you know, wrapping up the show now, guys, but it's that same kind of, you know, ideal that is brings about what we're talking about, the participation to make sure you get there to the events, you know.
Sure.
And, you know, and while you're at the event, am I going to provide service or am I going to rely on a hierarchy because I've been here X amount of years?
You know, there's an expression in the Army about that. You said, am I going to provide service? And that just rung so true with me. Am I going to provide service or am I going to suck up service? Am I going to be a service consumer or am I going to be a service provider? Now, you're out there as part of a team. So, obviously, you want to be a service provider. The Army says it this way. You're a liability or you're an asset. Every single patrol we go on, every single member here is a liability or they're an asset. Obviously, we want assets. What are you going to be?
Well, you know, I mean, it seems like with both of your respective events, you know, I haven't had the pleasure of going to Eastwind yet. That's going to change next year. I will be there. I'll be covering it, actually, for Battle Rattle.
Yeah.
But certainly been involved over the years off and on with One Shepherd and in recent years. And it's obvious that both those environments are already intact to bring that out, where you can identify and say asset or liability, you know.
Sure.
And that question exists in a lot of the doctrine and a lot of the task building that you guys put together in your training programs. That's a great show, guys, and we're getting close to the end of it. I mean, is there anything that you want to throw in there as far as event planning, any last-minute monologues or words of wisdom from Mr. Swayze?
Not really a ton, other than to say that just remember that when you're working with people who are planning events and you're saying you're willing to make a commitment to something, that as soon as you say you're making that commitment, that person's putting a tick mark on a piece of paper, and they're thinking about things, and they're planning for you, and all that kind of thing. So if you're one of the 40 people who says, yeah, I'm going to be there, and doesn't come, then that really detracts away from the experience everybody else has, because now everyone else is going to a field with, you know, 40 extra MREs per meal and no freaking ammunition.
Yeah.
Not hungry, but I don't have any bullets. Not going to starve, but...
Yeah, the accordion effect of that commitment. Of course, you know, we know people have lives outside beyond the community, but yeah, I'll just echo, to wrap up, I'll just echo what Alan said, and that is that when you tell one of these people that are just incredibly burdened with getting everything set right, and you say, yes, I'm going to do that, in their mind, they've checked that off. That's done. You've taken that off their plate. They're very thankful. Make sure you do it.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. Perfect sense. Well, this is our second show back here on that you'll be able to access through, OD Journal.
OD Journal.
So you've been listening to Battle Rattle with Alan Swayze from Operation Eastwind, and of course Chris Larson from One Shepherd. And thanks again for joining us. You can check out next week. We'll be on OD Journal again one more time for you. So check us out here on Battle Rattle. And thanks again for listening.
All right. Bye.